from Amarillo, this small Texas town is now the backdrop for the
high-stakes hearing in the courtroom behind me. In the
Judge
case
Matthew
where
Kaczmarek waited until the last minute to file the case and told attorneys to keep the date of the hearing a secret to avoid the possibility of
protests happening right now. They said they'll be back tonight.
This is the biggest abortion-related case since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year.
The scene outside the federal courthouse in the remote Texas panhandle city of Amarillo today, where a federal judge heard a case that could undo the Food and Drug Administration's decades-old approval of mifepristone. It's one of the drugs used in medication abortions, the most common way now to end pregnancies. We're going to talk about what's at stake now with Michelle Goodwin. She's a law professor at UC Irvine and author of the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
All right. So this lawsuit was filed by a group, a conservative group called the Alliance Defending Freedom, on behalf of four anti-abortion medical organizations and four doctors. Tell us what they're claiming here.
What they're claiming is that the Food and Drug Administration lacked the authority to approve the drug and that the FDA rushed the drug to the market without thorough consideration of the health implications. Now, this is even though the drug had been used for decades in Europe and has been found to be safe and effective, not only by the Food and Drug Administration, but by leading medical and science organizations, not only in the United States, but around the world.
What about this claim, though, that the FDA rushed it to market? Is there any truth to that?
Well, the reality is that the drug was available to come into the market even before the Food and Drug Administration had brought it to the marketplace. It had already been used in Europe for decades before. So if you look at it that way, there was no rush. In fact, for some time, the criticism has been that the Food and Drug Administration has been rather slow in advancing the kinds of medications and prescriptions and drugs that benefit women and that are effective for women and that help women in the arc of their own health and safety. So the other side of this argument is that the FDA has been incredibly slow when it's come to advancing the health concerns of women and bringing to market the kinds of drugs that women seek to have.
And in terms of the safety, can you put this into context? Because, of course, pregnancy and actually carrying a baby to term is also risky for, it can be risky for the mother and for the baby. But in the context, how safe are these drugs?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I'm glad that you are asking that because we've become so far distant from medicine and science and the way in which these cases have been brought. In 2016, the United States Supreme Court acknowledged that in a study done of women and pregnancy and abortion, that a woman is 14 times more likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than by having an abortion. By the rhetoric that's brought about in these cases, one would think that it's the opposite. One would think, because of the rhetoric, that the riskier choice for a woman would be having an abortion, where the reality is that the United States is the deadliest country in all of the industrialized world to actually be pregnant. In the Dobbs case, in which the United States Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, it was a case brought by the state of Mississippi. In Mississippi, if you happen to be a Black woman, you're 118 times more likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than by having an abortion. And much of this data, this is data that we get from those states, from their health departments, from the data that they are keeping and from the federal government. So this is not data that is made up by some fringe organizations, but rather this is information that we've known for quite some time. And to your point with regard to the health and safety, according to the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, known as ACOG, serious side effects associated with this drug, it's called mifepristone, occurs in less than 1% of patients. And so it's incredibly safe. Mm-hmm. So what this does is it defies reason in many ways. As one tries to understand litigation like this, it requires us to contort our understanding of medicine and science.
And So the group that I mentioned, the ADF, which is bringing the case today, acknowledged apparently in today's hearing that there is no precedent for a court to order the suspension of a long-approved medication. And the judge in this case, Matthew Kaczmarek, seemed to press the ADF on this. And so why do you think he took this case in the first place? I mean, we do know that he is conservative and that he has held anti-abortion views.
It's a great question, and I think it relates to the broader concerns that Americans have about the judiciary and the judiciary being politicized to such a degree that now even the United States Supreme Court has the lowest approval rating ever, even lower than that of Congress, which is really stunning. But I think it reflects the kind of politicized nature of our court. During President Trump's run for office, he made clear that he would only nominate and seek to get appointed judges that would overturn Roe, judges that would seek to ban or block abortion, judges that would be willing to punish women who have abortions. And part of your question leads to the concern about Judge Kaczmarek, who's been very vocal in his opposition to matters of reproductive freedom. And also the concern is that it looks like it's forum shopping. He's a lone district court judge in a little corner of Texas, big state, but this is a small corner. And the concern is that it looks like forum shopping, that this was the judge that these particular litigants would be able to appeal to take up this case, which could have implications for the rest of the country. And not only that, what's really so dangerous about this particular case and the way in which it's been brought is that it could have implications for many other drugs, from COVID-19 boosters to medicines used in gender-affirming therapies.
Hmm. All right. So what are his options here? Could he just, with a stroke of a pen, ban the sale of this drug? Is that even possible?
Well, it wouldn't be the full ban of the sale of the drug, but it could be that there is a ban in terms of the way in which the FDA allows it to be distributed. Of course, he could do anything that he wants. So let me just back that up and say that what we have seen in our judiciary, things that we would not have imagined before. We just saw the Supreme Court overturn nearly 50 years of precedent in Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. So we don't know exactly what it is that this judge will do. It could very well be that very soon mifepristol, which is a drug that is used in terminating pregnancies, which is safe and effective, could then not be available or not as easily available. There are a range of options that this judge could seek to use, but it's hard to gamble on what exactly will be the outcome until we see what his opinion is in this case.
All right. Michelle Goodwin is a law professor at UC Irvine and author of the book Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Coming up, violent crime is up in LA's subway system, and people are also overdosing more now. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LA's trains and buses are facing a big increase in crime. Last year, there was a nearly 25% increase in violent crime like murder, assault, and rape. In the first few months of this year, there has been a large increase in people dying of drug overdoses, mainly fentanyl. It's not unusual in some train stations to see people shooting up or smoking drugs, even during rush hour. And that's one reason fewer commuters are using public transportation now. Ridership is so low, one city councilman called it Metro's existential crisis. Rachel Uranga wrote about this for the LA Times, where she covers transportation and mobility. Welcome to Press Play, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right, well, let's just set the scene. And you began your piece at the MacArthur Park station, which really is the worst one, right? It's been described as the epicenter of this crime and drug problem. What did you see?
when I initially got there, we arrived with my photographer and there were police out there detaining people. I think there's been a real effort to beef up security. But there were a lot of people hanging out in the plaza even before we descended into the subterranean platform, just out there smoking or, you know, looking around for folks. If you go around the corner, it's an open air drug market. I mean, there are people using and gathering and, you know, gathering together, taking drugs. And it's not unusual to see that at that station.
And you followed one guy, Matthew Morales, and just describe what he was doing on the train.
Sure. So I met Matthew up on the plaza level, and he told us that he was looking around for other people to use fentanyl with. And what I've been told is that sometimes users will, quote unquote, match with somebody. So they'll take fentanyl together so they're not alone. And he agreed to go with us on the train and do what he was going to do anyway. He was going to go smoke a little. So we went down the train station and he found a chair on the last train and he smoked. When I initially talked to him, he seemed very present. He didn't appear to be very intoxicated. He wasn't even that jittery, but by the time we got in the train, he had really devolved and it was very heart-wrenching to see him.
Yeah. So he went into kind of an opiate slump or something like that. What was the reaction on the part of the people who work there in Metro? Were there workers there who saw him and what did they do?
That day, the conductor glanced and just walked by. Talking to other operators there, I've heard that this is something that they're accustomed to and that it's not unusual for them to see it, especially on the red line, which I think is really the heart of the problem for Metro, at least. It's the first Los Angeles subway line, and it's the one most frequently used. And it's also where they've seen the biggest problems.
And the red line goes from Union Station to Hollywood. How busy is it with commuters?
It's pretty busy. I think that line itself has about 20, or that station, I should say, has about 22,000 daily boardings. I don't know the exact number for weekdays for the full line. But certainly Metro is dealing with a drop in ridership that was brought on by the pandemic as people stayed at home and didn't have to go into city centers anymore.
So this is mainly a problem, the crime problem. It's mainly a problem on the trains. What's happening on the buses?
I don't think they're seeing those same numbers. And it's a little bit more complicated to track too, because the trains, they track per station. And the buses, they're not doing that. And I just don't think they have the crime numbers that they do on the rails. And the rails are like, just generally, they're an attractive place to people who might want to be riding for a long period of time. You know, if you just think about it, right, getting on a rail car, it's quieter, you're not as having as many bumps, people aren't coming in and out as frequently, there's not stops. It's just a different environment than a bus.
Yeah. All right. So what you're talking about in terms of the crime and the overdose deaths, that's mainly happening in the train system, not so much on the bus system. So is this happening throughout Metro or is it pretty much concentrated on the red line?
Well, there's overdoses throughout the system. But in terms of instances of crime, I think that the highest instances of that is on the red line. So I was telling the numbers before we got on. There were 4 homicides on the red line last year, 7 instances of rape. I mean, these aren't huge numbers, but they're also, you have to consider what you're looking at. When you look at aggravated assaults, there was about 174. And about 303 instances of reported battery.
So with these increases, What is Metro doing? I know it unveiled this ambassadorship program recently, but these ambassadors are not police officers.
No, they're not police officers. And Metro is really struggling with how to deal with this. It's a political body. It's a 13-member board that is made up of the supervisors, Mayor Karen Bass, who's going to have 3 appointments on that board. And what they've largely done is they've relied on law enforcement, and it's created a big backlash among some social justice activists who say that law enforcement unfairly targets writers of color, you know, that they're often, you know, that they were citing people for things like fare evasion, things that can stick, you know, stick with you and become problematic for the largely poor ridership that depends on the Metro. So Metro created an ambassador program. The ambassadors are meant to help people feel secure, help guide them places. And that's still rolling out. So we'll see how that works out. I mean, definitely when I was out there, you did see that the ambassadors really helped people who may not feel secure, who didn't know where they were going and so forth. But there's not much you can do about people who might be using drugs on the system or who might be passed out. I mean, even the law enforcement is really limited in what they can do. And I think that's really the conundrum for the Metro Board.
Right. With the larger picture being that Metro wants to get more people riding, especially in anticipation of the coming World Cup and the coming Olympics.
Sure. And also, I mean, Metro and the state of California are trying to reduce greenhouse gases. And there's only one real way to do it, and that's to get people out of their car and not driving as much. So the importance of public transportation is going to play in that. It's going to be really crucial. And if they can't get people to start taking the train, the bus, whatever it is to get out of their car, then they're going to be facing other hurdles down the road.
Well, Rachel, thank you. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
Rachel Urenga covers transportation for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, Lily Tomlin is here. She'll talk about her long working and personal relationship with Jane Fonda.
So I said to Jane one day on the set of Grace and Frankie, I said, I'm going to call Paul and ask him to write a movie for us. He called and he said, I've got an idea. It just starts out, you know, with one character saying to another, I'm going to kill you.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Ladies, don't let anybody tell you you are ever past your prime.
That's Michelle Yeoh, who at age 60 won the Best Actress Prize for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Lily Tomlin is living those words, and she's a lot older. She's 83. She's won an Emmy, a Grammy, a Tony, and has yet to win an Oscar, but maybe there's still time. Lily Tomlin's professional story begins in 1969 in comedy when she did characters on the TV show Laugh-In'.
One rinny dinny. gracious hello. Is this General Motors? Hi, General. How's everything in the Pentagon? Tell me, how's Mrs. Motors?
And in 1975, she was cast in her first serious role in Robert Altman's Nashville. And, of course, there was a little movie called 9 to 5.
I'm a murderer.
No, you're not.
I'm a murderess.
Violet, you're nothing until proven guilty.
She starred alongside Jane Fonda then and more recently in the hit Netflix comedy series Grace and Frankie. Lily Tomlin is still working with Jane Fonda in two movies this year, 80 for Brady and Moving On, in which they play two college friends who reunite at a funeral and decide to exact revenge on their dead friend's husband.
A devoted wife and mother, a doting grandmother. Joyce was a wonderful woman.
Joyce. This is Claire, one of Joyce's oldest friends. They were at college together. Claire.
Howard, I'm going to kill you. Now that she's gone, I'm going to do it this weekend.
Lily Tomlin joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you, Madeline.
You were supposed to join us with Jane Fonda, but she, I guess, had a slight accident, but she's okay, right?
Yeah, she's fine.
Okay, good, good. So let's talk about the two of you, because you are in this movie together. You play friends, or I guess newly reacquainted friends. Describe your relationship.
Well, we're two old college mates who are reunited at a third friend's funeral 45 years later. And we plot to even the score on an injustice we've been a witness to and participant.
Right. Sort of a Me Too moment that happened many decades ago.
Right.
I understand this movie was written for you. Is that correct?
Yeah. Those things do happen.
How did that work? And why this particular plot involving you?
Well, I'd done two movies with Paul Weitz. I'd done Admission and I'd done Grandma. Mm-hmm. And so I said to Jane one day on the set of Grace and Frankie, I said, I'm going to call Paul and ask him to write a movie for us. He called and he said, I've got an idea. It just starts out, you know, with one character saying to another, I'm going to kill you this weekend.
Yeah, it's a good attention grabber. And did you work with him on the storyline, on the plot?
No.
On the characters?
No, not really.
So he wrote it, presented it to you, and you were like, yeah, okay, I'm in.
Yeah, that's right. No, I laughed at stuff. I thought it was terribly funny. And my character was, fairly glib and witty, had something, always something sassy to say about everything.
Yeah. And your character is a lesbian. She's out and proud. Is this the first character you've played who's been out?
No. I played a lesbian poet in Grandma.
Oh, right.
And in The Search, one of the characters, play my partner, wrote Jane Wagner. The Search for Signs of Intelligent. This is in a theater piece. The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. Mm-hmm. One of the characters is Edie. She's a lesbian, and she's in a relationship with Pam, and they have a child, Ivan, who is a prodigy.
That was a while ago, right?
It was 83 or 85 that was
on Broadway. So how revolutionary was that to have those characters in the early 80s on Broadway?
Well, I don't think it was terribly revolutionary. Maybe it was because they used a turkey baster to impregnate Pam. That was new and interesting for the audience to hear.
But you didn't have openly gay characters that often.
No, not that often. You have to have a good part, a meaningful part.
And that was written by your partner, Jane Wagner, who you've been with for more than 50 years?
I guess 53 or 54 years.
And I should say wife, not partner.
We're not keen on wife, although that's what a lot of people, you know, it's too heteronormative.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
We don't want to imitate. We want the gay community to come up with better ideas than just to copy the heterosexual community. Jane is a writer, and that's the main thing she is. She is a writer.
And she's written a lot for you. So you are also creative partners. And how did she help you in your career? How did she help you with certain roles and projects?
Well, she just might write a good, a better idea or some great lines or any number of things. I mean, she's a very talented writer, totally embraces the humanity. So she writes lines that have, they're comedic or they're funny, they're thoughtful, and so that's how she would always do something wonderful. Hmm. I mean, she would write a script for Edith Ann. When we animated Edith Ann for a while, and she wrote those scripts.
And this is a character, if people aren't familiar, that you created for Laugh-In back in the late 1960s.
Yeah. My old dog Buster, he don't smell good, and I have to give him a bath, but he don't like baths. So, because he don't like to be really clean. So when I washed him yesterday, I used 1 cup of bubble bath and 2 cups of dirt.
Oh my gosh. Describe that character, how you came up with her.
I wanted to do a young child. I introduced the telephone operator when I first went on. Mm-hmm. And she was a huge hit. Ernestine was just caught on like that. It was unbelievable. Hmm. And so then I kept trying to talk them into doing Edith Ann. And the writers didn't. They said she was bratty and she was this and she was that. And they just showed a little interest in her. So I said, just get me a big cardboard box, you know, like a refrigerator box. And she'll stick her head out. And then we won't have to have any size relationship. So they humored me and they let me do that for a couple of weeks. And she caught on unbelievably. Hmm. And I went out in the hallway one day and our show carpenter was building her rocking chair. I knew she found a place on a home on the show.
Her own gigantic chair.
Yeah. I had that chair in my house. I always kept a lot of stuff from different productions and things. It's a good way to furnish your pad.
What did you take from Nashville?
I don't know if I'd had enough sense to start collecting. That was the first movie I ever did. I kept some of the clothes.
So this is 1975 Nashville, and you play a gospel singer. And how did you get that role?
Well, Louise Fletcher was supposed to do that role. She's died now.
Oh, Nurse Ratched from...
Nurse Ratched, right. She won the Oscar that year.
Yeah.
And her husband was a producer, and he had worked with Bob Altman on... Thieves Like Us, which is a wonderful movie. Shelley Duvall is just drop-dead beautiful in it. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't find out about Louise for a long time. Bob just called me up one day. We had the same agent. He said, I want you to come down to Nashville and do a part in Nashville. And he gave me Louise's part. But of course, I had no idea that that was the case until the night of the Oscars. Louise was signing to her family. Sign language. Uh-huh. And I began to put two and two together.
Oh, because your kids in the movie are deaf.
And I studied sign language every day for 3 months. This girl would come to my door, knock on the door at like 8 a.m. And I just have to drag myself out and try to sign stuff. No matter what I did, I never got very good at it, but I could memorize certain passages. So I memorized long conversations with my son.
But this was your first dramatic role. And were you nervous to take a dramatic role after all the comedy?
No, I never saw any difference between comedy or drama.
Oh, that's interesting.
And depending on the style of the vehicle, you know, you can play it broader or less broad. So, no, I never had any problem with that. And I don't understand why people carry on about it so much.
Yeah.
I don't think they do so much anymore, but...
Right. People aren't as siloed, perhaps, as they were in the past. So the other Jane in your life, Jane Fonda, you worked with in 9 to 5, and you've been working with her, well, in a few projects since then, especially most notably the TV show that you just wrapped, Grace and Frankie. I just want to say it's just really beautiful to see two women with such a longstanding friendship, and which seems at least... when I watch you in interviews, genuine, warm, and heartfelt.
That's mostly due to me. I exude that heart warmth, that warmth of heart.
Have you been friends ever since 9 to 5? Or did it kind of wane and come back?
No, we knew each other, you know, very well, but we were totally up for the series. I mean, my agent called me and said, are you and Jane Fonda looking for something to do together on television? I said, well, I think we are now. And and so that was that. It was just so natural.
Yeah.
Jane is so busy doing climate change now. And I'm so grateful for her that she is. somehow I was at her house when she decided to go to D.C. And she said, well, I'm going to move to D.C. for a year. And I said, yeah. And she said, I've got to call into Ted Sarandos asking him to put off Grace and Frankie for a year.
So that she could do some activism?
Yeah, so she could go and establish Fire Drill Fridays and all the stuff she's doing for climate change. And I, when she said, I called Ted Sarandos and asked him if we could delay Grace and Frankie for a year, I didn't laugh, but I said, well, good luck with that. I wasn't sure. I thought, well, if anybody could talk Ted Sarandos into it, it's probably Jane. Yeah. But of course, she didn't talk him into it because here, Grace and Frankie was one of the hit shows on Netflix.
Yeah.
So, and then COVID hit. And so she had 4 months at least she could move to DC. And she did that. And, you know, she's been so inspired by Greta Thunberg. She just had to do something.
Does she try to get you involved in her political activism?
Just peripherally, you know, she got everybody involved. I mean, everybody went to DC and protested and got arrested, and that's inevitable with Jane.
Yeah.
Jane, here's the most beautiful thing Jane said. She said this years ago. Someone said to her, well, aren't you just being used by such and such a group? Or, you know, it's kind of a little backward dig. And she said, everybody's being used by someone. What better thing than to be used by good people for good things?
That's true.
You have to love her for it.
Yeah.
Just in general.
Do you think it's a big deal that it appears that older women are getting more recognition and more roles in Hollywood these days?
Yeah, sure. It's much, much better. I mean, it's not hugely better, but it's much better. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I had an agent who said to me, I wanted to be seen for a certain part. And he said, and I said, well, so-and-so is being seen for it. And he said, yeah, but she's 10 years younger than you. And I, well, she doesn't look it. I just was incensed because he said that.
Yeah. Was there a period where in your career where that was a big problem and you couldn't get the roles that you wanted?
No, I never wanted very many roles. I'd much rather go out and do my own act if I couldn't get a part that I wanted. Mm-hmm. Or that I thought, or to work with an artist that I thought was really gifted.
Yeah.
They, you know, they used to write parts for women that would be considered, you know, aged now. I mean, from 40, 50 years ago, an older woman would be 55, 60 at least. And they used to put a wig hat on your head and a, you know, an exercise suit and great big old tennies. And you'd be the butt of the jokes.
Yeah.
Like, you know, good natured and all that stuff. Well, you pretty soon, no woman, that's not the story of all women at all. And even if it were, they don't deserve to be made the butt of the joke.
Right. Also sexless, right? When you reach a certain age, you're not
absolutely,
supposed to
absolutely
be
sexless,
a sexual being. Yeah.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Well, Jane Fonda in this movie has a sex scene. You don't see it, but it's implied.
Oh. Well, yeah, but she had a couple of them in Grace and Frankie.
Yeah.
Frankie was, she just had a yurt put out on the patio and carry on.
So what are your next projects?
I don't have any for the moment. I'll come up with something.
I'm sure you will. Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, KCRW.
Lily Tomlin, starring in the new movie, Moving On, which is in theaters tomorrow. Coming up, we will talk about who may be on the shortlist to replace Gustavo Dudamel as the next conductor of the LA Philharmonic. That conversation with Alex Ross of The New Yorker is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
You know that I conduct this orchestra when I was 9 or 8 years old in a recording at home. You know, I have to say that, you know, I conduct the New York Philharmonic already at home for my family, for a good audience, for my puppets. A lot.
That's Los Angeles Philharmonic conductor Gustavo Dudamel speaking with the New York Philharmonic last month, just after being named its next music director. He'll take over in 3 years. He told that orchestra, it's a dream come true. After all, consider who came before him: Bernstein, Mahler, Boulez, Toscanini. When Dudamel came to Los Angeles, he was just 26 years old, and that was in 2009. He helped make the Los Angeles Phil arguably the best orchestra in the country. So what happens now? Can LA find another star conductor? Joining me is Alex Ross, music critic at The New Yorker. Hi.
Hi, it's great to be back on the show. Thanks, Bolan.
Great to have you back. Well, you live here in LA. What was your reaction when you first heard that Dudamel was going to New York?
Well, I've been hearing for a year or more that this was possible or even likely to happen. And actually had a little hard time believing it because from my point of view, it's a little bit of a step down for him. You know, the LA Phil is a great orchestra with enormous resources, with a sense of identity and direction and audience that's eager for experiment. And the New York Philharmonic, while, you know, historically a great ensemble, is not quite in that same position. But, you know, it makes sense when you just look at his career and the need for everyone eventually to move on and go to some new position. He will have been in LA for 17 years, so that's a good long time. So
yeah.
In the end, it's not terribly surprising. But I think he's going to miss a lot of things about the Los Angeles and the LA Phil.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm wondering, if you say it is a step down, why would he take this position? I know, yes, as I mentioned, the storied past of the New York Phil, but that is the past.
Well, I mean, it's a very good orchestra. It is also quite a bit closer to Europe. You know, he lives mainly in Spain, and he also has this very big job conducting in Paris.
The Paris Opera.
And, yeah. You know, I don't know what kind of salary he was offered, but it could have been a very large amount. He also just, I think, hit it off with this orchestra. He had been conducting on and off the New York Phil for many years. They really wanted him. They really thought that there was a strong rapport there. And, you know, that's the important thing. It has to be a relationship. You know, it can't just be that a few right. people decide, oh, conductor X is good for our orchestra. There needs to be a strong sense of community, sort of, you know, common ground between the conductor and the orchestra.
Well, what was, or how important was, I should say, the role of Deborah Borda, who used to run things here and then went to New York? Was it always her intention to bring Dudamel with her? She brought him to LA in the first place.
Right. Not sure whether, you know, early on that was her intention, but certainly in the last year or two, she has been extremely focused on getting this done. And, you know, she's an enormously powerful force, very persuasive, very effective, a brilliant administrator. So it's not surprising that, you know, ultimately when she put her mind to it, it came to pass. She's a really remarkable person. But I'm a little wary of, you know, seeing Dudamel as, you know, such a superstar that, you know, when he goes to an orchestra, that orchestra is sort of saved. And, you know, the orchestra that loses him is doomed. I don't think the, you know, LA Phil and its audience should feel too distraught by this, because they were a very mighty force before he came, and they will remain so now that he's left. And that's not to say that, you know, Dudamel is a fantastic conductor, just in the technical terms. You know, he's remarkable. And he does also have this charisma and this sense of, I don't know, this sort of instant communion that he creates with audiences.
Yeah.
If he walks out on stage and people feel embraced, they feel kind of an energy coming from him that's not standoffish, that's not aloof. They feel drawn into the, you know, ritual that he's about to undertake. And that is a fairly precious resource.
Well, let's hear a little bit of what you're talking about. And this is Dudamel leading the LA Philharmonic, playing Dvorak's Seventh Symphony. Wait, so you talk about Dudamel just having this thing, this charisma when he walks on stage. How does that translate into the technical aspect of the job?
Well, it's interesting. I think there is, for me, a little bit of a divide between Dudamel's popular image and the actual substance of the performances that he delivers. So he has this image as someone very approachable, very, very passionate, sort of this galvanic force. And, you know, you can find some of those same qualities in the performances. But in fact, as a conductor, he's quite meticulous. He's not one to go for kind of really extreme gestures. There's a kind of middle of the road sort of rational way he goes about conducting pieces. He was just a superb musician and sort of knows exactly what he wants and is able to communicate very crisply and easily to the orchestra his desires. And so he's just a very fine technician. He's also, I think, raised the quality of the orchestra over the past, you know, well, been, again, 17 years by the time he leaves. It was a brilliant orchestra when he started, but it had a sort of a few weak points in the ensemble, and he is hired or assisted in the hiring of excellent musicians across the board. So the orchestra now has a real kind of solidity, balance of sound in all the different sections, strings, winds, and brass. He leaves a real legacy in that respect.
He also was quite a force outside of the Disney Concert Hall, and he was a very big proponent of musical education. And I'm thinking of, obviously, YOLA, the Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, which he founded, and as an offshoot or in the mirror image of El Sistema, which he grew up in. So I want to play a clip of him talking in that talk that he gave to the New York Phil about the importance of musical education. And here he is.
When you give an instrument to a child, you know, it's something you are giving to this child beauty. You are giving the chance to this young boy, young girl, to create their own world, having the opportunity of contemplate, of interact with others that are creating beauty, because that is harmony, that is rhythm, that is melody.
So, and he goes on to say that really that learning music and appreciating music as a child can really lead to positive social change. Can you talk about that side of his tenure here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably going to turn out to be his most important legacy, because he really has built a new institution. And, you know, this is going to be very hard to replace. So, you know, to find someone who is an extremely skilled conductor who also has this gift for education, for speaking with young people and sort of coming across as someone, you know, with whom they can identify, who had just has the passion for it. I mean, this has been just such a driving passion of his, you know, going back to his days as a youthful conductor in El Sistema. But I think the great thing about an institution such as the LA Phil, and there are very few institutions like it, is that, you know, in a lot of other places, you have kind of one very inspiring figure who comes along and makes changes and gets everyone excited, and then they leave, and then everything kind of reverts to the way it was. It's a very familiar story, not only in music, but, you know, in sort of all different areas of culture and society. With the LA Phil, you know, the innovation seemed to stick. So, you know, Esabeca Salin left, but kind of everything he had built remained in place, in terms of, you know, the success of the Green Umbrella series, all the new music programming, the kind of curiosity that he and the orchestra managed to instill in audiences, kind of sense, you know, the readiness of audiences to go along with new and sometimes very challenging music. And so my expectation is that, you know, when Dudamel leaves, this other you know, institution, this other kind of new way of thinking and working that he built will also remain in place. Of course, nothing is written in stone, and eventually the LA Phil could sort of go back to a sort of a much more kind of conventional institution. I'd be very sad to see that happen. But my hope is that there's enough real pride and sense of identity that has developed with the orchestra, the players, the board, the administration, and I think most importantly, the audience, mm-hmm. you know, this sort of this will for all of this to continue.
All right. So let's talk about the future and who is on the short list to be the next conductor, the next music director of the LA Phil.
Oh, some various names have been bandied about. The one that I sort of put forward most strongly is Susanna Melki, the Finnish conductor who, until very recently, was the principal guest conductor of the orchestra, and who I think is a really marvelous conductor who's produced very substantial results in the mainstream repertory, as well as the new music. And that, you know, she was sort of best known early on for conducting new music, and she's led some really important premieres, including operas of Kaija Saariaho, her solo Finnish composer. So for me, she'd be at the top of the list, but of course, you know, there are many, many factors involved here. Mm-hmm. The opinions of the critics are probably fairly low down on the list. You know, what do the players think of different conductors? What does the administration think and the board? And so it's a little mysterious. You know, I'm not going to sort of risk predicting how it might turn out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some other conductors out there. David Robertson is very well liked by the orchestra. A couple of younger names have been suggested. So, we'll see what happens.
Well, it certainly would be revolutionary to hire a woman for a major orchestra in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, no orchestra in the world of the level that the sort of LA Phil inhabits, which is kind of the top tier of orchestras. You can debate about what that means or who qualifies, but it's pretty indisputable that no woman has ever held a position this prominent in the orchestral world, which is a very sad state of affairs. And so it's certainly time, and it feels as though it would be very much in the tradition of the LA Phil to break this bad tradition and finally have a woman in the top seat. I really would not be surprised if that happens, but again, there are all kinds of other factors at play.
All right, well, let's hear a little bit of what Susanna Melki can do. We are going to hear her conducting a piece called Music for Ensemble and Orchestra 5/16 by the composer Steve Reich. And we're going to go out on that. So do you want to set this up for us?
Yes, yeah, so this is Susanna Melki showing her chops in new music. Steve Reich, the great canonical American minimalist composer, was enticed back to writing for orchestra after many years writing for smaller ensembles. And not surprisingly, the LA Phil was one of the ensembles that brought him back.
Okay, well, here it is. This came out late last year. This is Music for Ensemble and Orchestra 5/16. Alex Ross, music critic at The New Yorker. It has been such a pleasure. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Reach out, touch faith. Think Steve Reich and Depeche Mode have nothing to do with each other. You might be correct. However, Depeche Mode is here to remind you that you should donate now to win 2 premium tickets to see Depeche Mode live in concert. You can enjoy a meet and greet with the band, signed album art, the latest record on vinyl, and a brand new Crosley turntable. Support KCRW by Sunday night to be automatically entered to win. Just go to kcrw.com/give and good luck. All right, let's hear some more Depeche Mode. I'm Madeline Brown. I'll see you tomorrow.